launched it. And what's so interesting about this IP? I ran a delegator that tapped a search engine at this IP and pulled a redacted document. I need to see the rest of the document. I'm happy to pay them for it, but I can't figure out who owns the IP or how to access it. Zubianis frowned at his screen. Are you sure about this? I'm running a diagnostic, and this firewall coding looks pretty serious. That's why you get the big bucks. Zubianis considered it. They'd offered him a fortune for a job this easy. One question, Trish. Why are you so hot on this? Trish paused. I'm doing a favor for a friend. Must be a special friend. She is. Zubianis chuckled and held his tongue. I knew it. Look, Trish said, sounding impatient. Are you good enough to unmask this IP? Yes or no? Yes, I'm good enough, and yes, I know you're playing me like a fiddle. How long will it take you? Not long, he said, typing as he spoke. I should be able to get into a machine on their network within 10 minutes or so. Once I'm in and know what I'm looking at, I'll call you back. I appreciate it. So are you doing well? Now, she asks. Trish, for God's sake, you called me on the night of a playoff game and now you want to chat? Do you want me to hack this IP or not? Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it. I'll be waiting for your call. 15 minutes. Zubianis hung up, grabbed his bowl of pirate's booty, and unmuted the game. Women. Chapter 28. Where are they taking me? As Langdon hurried with Anderson and Sato into the depths of the capital, he felt his heart rate increasing with each downward step. They had begun their journey through the west portico of the rotunda, descending a marble staircase and then doubling back through a wide doorway into the famous chamber directly beneath the rotunda floor. The Capitol Crypt. The air was heavier here, and Langdon was already feeling claustrophobic. The crypt's low ceiling and soft uplighting accentuated the robust girth of the 40 Doric columns required to support the vast stone floor directly overhead. Relax, Robert.
This way, Anderson said, moving quickly as he angled to the left across the wide circular space.
Thankfully, this particular crypt contained no bodies. Instead, it contained several statues, a model of the Capitol, and a low storage area for the wooden catafalque on which coffins were laid for state funerals. The entourage hurried through, without even a glance at the four-pointed marble compass in the center of the floor, where the eternal flame had once burned. Anderson seemed to be in a hurry, and Sato once again had her head buried in her BlackBerry. Cellular service, Langdon had heard, was boosted and broadcast to all corners of the Capitol building to support the hundreds of government phone calls that took place here every day. After diagonally crossing the crypt, the group entered a dimly lit foyer and began winding through a convoluted series of hallways and dead ends. The warren of passages contained numbered doorways, each of which bore an identification number. Langdon read the doors as they snaked their way around. S-154, S-153, S-152. He had no idea what lay behind these doors, but at least one thing now seemed clear: the meaning of the tattoo on Peter Solomon's palm. SBB-13 appeared to be a numbered doorway somewhere in the bowels of the U.S. Capitol building. What are all these doorways? Langdon asked, clutching his day bag tightly to his ribs and wondering what Solomon's tiny package could possibly have to do with a door marked SBB-13.
Offices and storage, Anderson said. Private offices and storage, he added, glancing back at Sato.
Sato did not even glance up from her BlackBerry. They look tiny, Langdon said.
Glorified closets, most of them, but they're still some of the most sought-after real estate in D.C. This is the heart of the original Capitol, and the old Senate chamber is two stories above us.
And SBB-13? Langdon asked. Whose office is that?
Nobody's. The SBB is a private storage area, and I must say I'm puzzled how—
Chief Anderson,
Sato interrupted, without looking up from her BlackBerry.
Just take us there, please.
Anderson clenched his jaw and guided them on in silence through what was now feeling like a hybrid self-storage facility and epic labyrinth. On almost every wall, directional signs pointed back and forth, apparently attempting to locate specific office blocks in this network of hallways. S-142 to S-152. ST-1 to ST-70. H1 to H166 and HT1 to HT67. Langdon doubted he could ever find his way out of here alone. This place is a maze. From all he could gather, office numbers began with either an S or an H, depending on whether they were on the Senate side of the building or the House side. Areas designated ST and HT were apparently on a level that Anderson called terrace level. Still no signs for SBB. Finally, they arrived at a heavy steel security door with a keycard entry box. SB level. Langdon sensed they were getting closer. Anderson reached for his keycard but hesitated, looking uncomfortable with Sato's demands.
Chief,
Sato prompted,
we don't have all night.
Anderson reluctantly inserted his keycard. The steel door released. He pushed it open, and they stepped through into the foyer beyond. The heavy door clicked shut behind them. Langdon wasn't sure what he had hoped to see in this foyer, but the sight in front of him was definitely not it. He was staring at a descending stairway. Down again? He said, stopping short. There's a level under the crypt?
Yes, Anderson said. SB stands for Senate Basement.
Langdon groaned. Terrific.
Chapter 29. The headlights winding up the SMSC's wooded access road were the first the guard had seen in the last hour. Dutifully, he turned down the volume on his portable TV set and stashed his snacks beneath the counter. Lousy timing. The Redskins were completing their opening drive, and he didn't want to miss it. As the car drew closer, the guard checked the name on the notepad in front of him. Dr. Christopher Abaddon. Catherine Solomon had just called to alert security of this guest's imminent arrival. The guard had no idea who this doctor might be, but he was apparently very good at doctoring. He was arriving in a black stretch limousine. The long, sleek vehicle rolled to a stop beside the guardhouse, and the driver's tinted window lowered silently.
Good evening,
the chauffeur said, doffing his cap. He was a powerfully built man with a shaved head. He was listening to the football game on his radio.
I have Dr. Christopher Abaddon for Miss Catherine Solomon.
The guard nodded. Identification, please. The chauffeur looked surprised.
I'm sorry, didn't Miss Solomon call ahead?
The guard nodded, stealing a glance at the television. I'm still required to scan and log visitor identification. Sorry, regulations. I'll need to see the doctor's ID.
Not a problem.
The chauffeur turned backward in his seat and spoke in hushed tones through the privacy screen. As he did, the guard stole another peek at the game. The Redskins were breaking from the huddle now, and he hoped to get this limo through before the next play. The chauffeur turned forward again and held out the ID that he'd apparently just received through the privacy screen. The guard took the card and quickly scanned it into his system. The DC driver's license showed one Christopher Abaddon from Kalorama Heights. The photo depicted a handsome blonde gentleman wearing a blue blazer, a necktie, and a satin pocket square. Who the hell wears a pocket square to the DMV? A muffled cheer went up from the television set, and the guard wheeled just in time to see a Redskins player dancing in the end zone, his finger pointed skyward. I missed it, the guard grumbled, returning to the window. Okay, he said, returning the license to the chauffeur. You're all set. As the limo pulled through, the guard returned to his TV, hoping for a replay. As Malak drove his limo up the winding access road, he couldn't help but smile. Peter Solomon's secret museum had been simple to breach. Sweeter still, tonight was the second time in 24 hours that Malak had broken into one of Solomon's private spaces. Last night, a similar visit had been made to Solomon's home. Although Peter Solomon had a magnificent country estate in Potomac, he spent much of his time in the city at his penthouse apartment at the exclusive Dorchester Arms. His building, like most that catered to the super-rich, was a veritable fortress. High walls, guard gates, guest lists, secured underground parking. Malak had driven this very limousine up to the building's guardhouse, doffed his chauffeur's cap from his shaved head, and proclaimed,
"I have Dr. Christopher Abaddon. He is an invited guest of Mr. Peter Solomon."
Malak spoke the words as if he were announcing the Duke of York. The guard checked a log, and then Abaddon's ID,
Yes, I see Mr. Solomon is expecting Dr. Abaddon. He pressed a button and the gate opened. Mr. Solomon is in the penthouse apartment. Have your guest use the last elevator on the right. It goes all the way up.
Thank you.
Malak tipped his hat and drove through. As he wound deep into the garage, he scanned for security cameras. Nothing. Apparently, those who lived here were neither the kind of people who broke into cars, nor the kind of people who appreciated being watched. Malak parked in a dark corner near the elevators, lowered the divider between the driver's compartment and the passenger compartment, and slithered through the opening into the back of the limo. Once in back, he got rid of his chauffeur's cap and donned his blonde wig. Straightening his jacket and tie, he checked the mirror to make sure he had not smeared his makeup. Malak was not about to take any chances. Not tonight.
I have waited too long for this.
Seconds later, Malak was stepping into the private elevator. The ride to the top was silent and smooth. When the door opened, he found himself in an elegant private foyer. His host was already waiting.
Dr. Abaddon, welcome.
Malak looked into the man's famous gray eyes and felt his heart begin to race.
Mr. Solomon, I appreciate your seeing me.
Please call me Peter. The two men shook hands. As Malak gripped the older man's palm, he saw the gold Masonic ring on Solomon's hand, the same hand that had once aimed a gun at Malak. A voice whispered from Malak's distant past. If you pull that trigger, I will haunt you forever.
Please come in,
Solomon said, ushering Malak into an elegant living room whose expansive windows offered an astonishing view of the Washington skyline.
Do I smell tea steeping?
Malak asked as he entered. Solomon looked impressed.
My parents always greeted guests with tea. I've carried on that tradition.
He led Malak into the living room, where a tea service was waiting in front of the fire.
Cream and sugar?
Black, thank you.
Again, Solomon looked impressed. A purist. He poured them both a cup of black tea.
You said you needed to discuss something with me that was sensitive in nature, and could be discussed only in private.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
You and I are Masonic brothers now. We have a bond. Tell me how I can help you.
First, I would like to thank you for the honor of the 33rd degree a few months ago. This is deeply meaningful to me.
I'm glad, but please know that those decisions are not mine alone. They are by the vote of the Supreme Council.
Of course.
Malak suspected Peter Solomon had probably voted against him, but within the Masons, as with all things, money was power. Malak, after achieving the 32nd degree in his own lodge, had waited only a month before making a multi-million dollar donation to a charity in the name of the Masonic Grand Lodge. The unsolicited act of selflessness, as Malak anticipated, was enough to earn him a quick invitation into the elite 33rd degree.
And yet, I have learned no secrets.
Despite the age-old whispers, all is revealed at the 33rd degree, Malak had been told nothing new, nothing of relevance to his quest. But he had never expected to be told. The inner circle of Freemasonry contained smaller circles still, circles Malak would not see for years, if ever. He didn't care. His initiation had served its purpose. Something unique had happened within that temple room, and it had given Malak power over all of them.
I no longer play by your rules.
You do realize,
Malak said, sipping his tea,
that you and I met many years ago.
Solomon looked surprised. Really? I don't recall.
It was quite a long time ago.
And Christopher Abaddon is not my real name.
I'm so sorry. My mind must be getting old. Remind me how I know you. Malak smiled one last time at the man he hated more than any other man on earth.
It's unfortunate that you don't recall.
In one fluid motion, Malak pulled a small device from his pocket and extended it outward, driving it hard into the man's chest. There was a flash of blue light, the sharp sizzle of the stun gun discharge, and a gasp of pain as 1 million volts of electricity coursed through Peter Solomon's body. His eyes went wide, and he slumped motionless in his chair. Malak stood up now, towering over the man, salivating like a lion about to consume his injured prey. Solomon was gasping, straining to breathe. Moloch saw fear in his victim's eyes, and wondered how many people had ever seen the great Peter Solomon cower. Moloch savored the scene for several long seconds. He took a sip of tea, waiting for the man to catch his breath. Solomon was twitching, attempting to speak.
Why?
He finally managed.
Why do you think?
Moloch demanded. Solomon looked truly bewildered.
You want money?
Money?
Moloch laughed and took another sip of tea.
I gave the Masons millions of dollars. I have no need of wealth.
I come for wisdom, and he offers me wealth.
Then what do you want?
You possess a secret. You will share it with me tonight.
Solomon struggled to lift his chin so he could look Moloch in the eye.
I don't understand.
No more lies,
Moloch shouted, advancing to within inches of the paralyzed man.
I know what is hidden here in Washington.
Solomon's gray eyes were defiant.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Moloch took another sip of tea and set the cup on a coaster.
You spoke those same words to me 10 years ago, on the night of your mother's death.
Solomon's eyes shot wide open.
You?
She didn't have to die, if you had given me what I demanded.
The older man's face contorted in a mask of horrified recognition and disbelief.
I warned you,
Moloch said.
If you pulled the trigger, I would haunt you forever.
But you're...
Moloch lunged, driving the taser hard into Solomon's chest again. There was another flash of blue light, and Solomon went completely limp. Moloch put the taser back in his pocket and calmly finished his tea. When he was done, he dabbed his lips with a monogrammed linen napkin and peered down at his victim.
Shall we go?
Solomon's body was motionless, but his eyes were wide and engaged. Moloch got down close and whispered in the man's ear.
I'm taking you to a place where only truth remains.
Without another word, Moloch wadded up the monogrammed napkin and stuffed it into Solomon's mouth. Then he hoisted the limp man onto his broad shoulders and headed for the private elevator. On his way out, he picked up Solomon's iPhone and keys from the hall table. Tonight you will tell me all your secrets, Moloch thought, including why you left me for dead all those years ago. Chapter 30 SB Level Senate Basement. Robert Langdon's claustrophobia gripped him more tightly with every hastening step of their descent. As they moved deeper into the building's original foundation, the air became heavy and the ventilation seemed non-existent. The walls down here were an uneven blend of stone and yellow brick. Director Sato typed on her BlackBerry as they walked. Langdon sensed a suspicion in her guarded manner, but the feeling was quickly becoming reciprocal. Sato still hadn't told him how she knew Langdon was here tonight. An issue of national security? He had a hard time understanding any relation between ancient mysticism and national security. Then again, he had a hard time understanding much of anything about this situation. Peter Solomon entrusted me with a talisman. A deluded lunatic tricked me into bringing it to the Capitol and wants me to use it to unlock a mystical portal, possibly in a room called SBB-13. Not exactly a clear picture. As they pressed on, Langdon tried to shake from his mind the horrible image of Peter's tattooed hand, transformed into the hand of the mysteries. The gruesome picture was accompanied by Peter's voice. The ancient mysteries, Robert, have spawned many myths, but that does not mean they themselves are fiction. Despite a career studying mystical symbols and history, Langdon had always struggled intellectually with the idea of the ancient mysteries and their potent promise of apotheosis. Admittedly, the historical record contained indisputable evidence that secret wisdom had been passed down through the ages, apparently having come out of the mystery schools in early Egypt. This knowledge moved underground, resurfacing in Renaissance Europe, where, according to most accounts, it was entrusted to an elite group of scientists within the walls of Europe's premier scientific think tank, the Royal Society of London, enigmatically nicknamed the Invisible College. This concealed college quickly became a brain trust of the world's most enlightened minds, those of Isaac Newton, Francis Bacon, Robert Boyle, and even Benjamin Franklin. Today, the list of modern fellows was no less impressive: Einstein, Hawking, Bohr, and Celsius. These great minds had all made quantum leaps in human understanding, advances that, according to some, were the result of their exposure to ancient wisdom hidden within the invisible college. Langdon doubted this was true, although certainly there had been an unusual amount of mystical work taking place within those walls. The discovery of Isaac Newton's secret papers in 1936 had stunned the world by revealing Newton's all-consuming passion for the study of ancient alchemy and mystical wisdom. Newton's private papers included a handwritten letter to Robert Boyle in which he exhorted Boyle to keep high silence regarding the mystical knowledge they had learned. "It cannot be communicated," Newton wrote, "without immense damage to the world." The meaning of this strange warning was still being debated today.
"Professor,"
Sato said suddenly, glancing up from her BlackBerry,
"despite your insistence that you have no idea why you're here tonight, perhaps you could shed light on the meaning of Peter Solomon's ring."
"I can try," Langdon said, refocusing. She produced the specimen bag and handed it to Langdon.
"Tell me about the symbols on his ring."
Langdon examined the familiar ring as they moved through the deserted passageway. Its face bore the image of a double-headed phoenix holding a banner proclaiming Ordo Ab Kau, and its chest was emblazoned with the number 33. The double-headed phoenix with the number 33 is the emblem of the highest Masonic degree. Technically, this prestigious degree existed solely within the Scottish Rite. Nonetheless, the rites and degrees of Masonry were a complex hierarchy that Langdon had no desire to detail for Sato tonight. Essentially, the 33rd degree is an elite honor reserved for a small group of highly accomplished Masons. All the other degrees can be attained by successful completion of the previous degree. But ascension to the 33rd degree is controlled. It's by invitation only.
"So you were aware that Peter Solomon was a member of this elite inner circle?"
"Of course. Membership is hardly a secret."
"And he is their highest-ranking official?"
"Currently, yes. Peter heads the Supreme Council 33rd degree, which is the governing body of the Scottish Rite in America. Langdon always loved visiting their headquarters, the House of the Temple, a classical masterpiece whose symbolic ornamentation rivaled that of Scotland's Roslyn Chapel.
"Professor, did you notice the engraving on the ring's band? It bears the words, 'All is revealed at the 33rd degree.'"
Langdon nodded. "It's a common theme in Masonic lore."
"Meaning, I assume, that if a Mason is admitted to this highest 33rd degree, then something special is revealed to him?"
"Yes, that's the lore. But probably not the reality. There's always been conspiratorial conjecture that a select few within this highest echelon of Masonry are made privy to some great mystical secret. The truth, I suspect, is probably far less dramatic. Peter Solomon often made playful allusions to the existence of a precious Masonic secret, but Langdon always assumed it was just a mischievous attempt to coax him into joining the Brotherhood. Unfortunately, tonight's events had been anything but playful. And there had been nothing mischievous about the seriousness with which Peter had urged Langdon to protect the sealed package in his day bag. Langdon glanced forlornly at the plastic bag containing Peter's gold ring. "Director," he asked, "would you mind if I held on to this?" She looked over.
"Why?"
"It's very valuable to Peter, and I'd like to return it to him tonight." She looked skeptical.
"Let's hope you get that chance."
"Thanks." Langdon pocketed the ring.
"Another question,"
Sato said, as they hastened deeper into the labyrinth.
"My staff said that while cross-checking the concepts of the 33rd degree and portal with Masonry, they turned up literally hundreds of references to a pyramid."
"That's not surprising either," Langdon said. "The pyramid builders of Egypt are the forerunners of the modern stonemasons. And the pyramid, along with Egyptian themes, is very common in Masonic symbolism."
"Symbolizing what?"
"The pyramid essentially represents enlightenment. It's an architectural symbol emblematic of ancient man's ability to break free from his earthly plane and ascend upward toward heaven, toward the golden sun, and ultimately toward the supreme source of illumination. She waited a moment.
Nothing else?
Nothing else. Langdon had just described one of history's most elegant symbols, the structure through which man elevated himself into the realm of the gods.
According to my staff, she said, it sounds like there is a much more relevant connection tonight. They tell me there exists a popular legend about a specific pyramid here in Washington, a pyramid that relates specifically to the Masons and the ancient mysteries.
Langdon now realized what she was referring to, and he tried to dispel the notion before they wasted any more time. I am familiar with the legend, Director, but it's pure fantasy. The Masonic Pyramid is one of D.C.'s most enduring myths, probably stemming from the pyramid on the Great Seal of the United States.
Why didn't you mention it earlier?
Langdon shrugged. Because it has no basis in fact. Like I said, it's a myth, one of many associated with the Masons.
And yet, this particular myth relates directly to the ancient mysteries?
Sure, as do plenty of others. The ancient mysteries are the foundation for countless legends that have survived in history. Stories about powerful wisdom protected by secret guardians like the Templars, the Rosicrucians, the Illuminati, the Alumbrados. The list goes on and on. They're all based on the ancient mysteries, and the Masonic Pyramid is just one example.
I see,
Sato said.
And what does this legend actually say?
Langdon considered it for a few steps, and then replied, Well, I'm no specialist in conspiracy theory, but I am educated in mythology, and most accounts go something like this. The ancient mysteries, the lost wisdom of the ages, have long been considered mankind's most sacred treasure, and like all great treasures, they have been carefully protected. The enlightened sages who understood the true power of this wisdom learned to fear its awesome potential. They knew that if this secret knowledge were to fall into uninitiated hands, the results could be devastating. As we said earlier, powerful tools can be used either for good or for evil. So, in order to protect the ancient mysteries, and mankind in the process, the early practitioners formed secret fraternities. Inside these brotherhoods, they shared their wisdom only with the properly initiated, passing the wisdom from sage to sage. Many believe we can look back and see the historical remnants of those who mastered the mysteries in the stories of sorcerers, magicians, and healers.
And the Masonic Pyramid?
Sato asked.
How does that fit in?
Well, Langdon said, striding faster now to keep pace, this is where history and myth begin to merge. According to some accounts, by the 16th century in Europe, almost all of these secret fraternities had become extinct, most of them exterminated by a growing tide of religious persecution. The Freemasons, it is said, became the last surviving custodians of the ancient mysteries. Understandably, they feared that if their own brotherhood one day died off like its predecessors, the ancient mysteries would be lost for all time.
And the pyramid?
Sato again pressed. Langdon was getting to it. The legend of the Masonic Pyramid is quite simple. It states that the Masons, in order to fulfill their responsibility of protecting this great wisdom for future generations, decided to hide it in a great fortress. Langdon tried to gather his recollections of the story. Again, I stress, this is all myth, but allegedly the Masons transported their secret wisdom from the Old World to the New World, here to America, a land they hoped would remain free from religious tyranny. And here, they built an impenetrable fortress, a hidden pyramid, designed to protect the ancient mysteries until the time that all of mankind was ready to handle the awesome power that this wisdom could communicate. According to the myth, the Masons crowned their great pyramid with a shining solid gold capstone as a symbol of the precious treasure within. The ancient wisdom capable of empowering mankind to his full human potential. Apotheosis.
Quite a story,
Sato said. Yes. The Masons fall victim to all kinds of crazy legends.
Obviously you don't believe such a pyramid exists.
Of course not, Langdon replied. There's no evidence whatsoever to suggest that our Masonic forefathers built any kind of pyramid in America, much less in D.C. It's pretty difficult to hide a pyramid, especially one large enough to hold all the lost wisdom of the ages. The legend, as Langdon recalled, never explained exactly what was supposed to be inside the Masonic pyramid. Whether it was ancient texts, occult writings, scientific revelations, or something far more mysterious. But the legend did say that the precious information inside was ingeniously encoded, and understandable only to the most enlightened souls. Anyway, Langdon said, this story falls into a category we symbologists call an archetypal hybrid, a blend of other classic legends, borrowing so many elements from popular mythology that it could only be a fictional construct, not historical fact. When Langdon taught his students about archetypal hybrids, he used the example of fairy tales, which were recounted across generations and exaggerated over time, borrowing so heavily from one another that they evolved into homogenized morality tales with the same iconic elements: virginal damsels, handsome princes, impenetrable fortresses, and powerful wizards. By way of fairy tales, this primeval battle of good versus evil is ingrained into us as children through our stories. Merlin versus Morgan Le Fay, St. George versus the dragon, David versus Goliath, Snow White versus the witch, and even Luke Skywalker battling Darth Vader. Sato scratched her head as they turned a corner and followed Anderson down a short flight of stairs.
Tell me this. If I'm not mistaken, pyramids were once considered mystical portals through which the deceased pharaohs could ascend to the gods, were they not?
True. Sato stopped short and caught Langdon's arm, glaring up at him with an expression somewhere between surprise and disbelief.
You're saying Peter Solomon's captor told you to find a hidden portal, and it didn't occur to you that he was talking about the Masonic Pyramid from this legend?
By any name, the Masonic Pyramid is a fairy tale. It's purely fantasy. Sato stepped closer to him now, and Langdon could smell her cigarette breath.
I understand your position on that, Professor, but for the sake of my investigation, the parallel is hard to ignore. A portal leading to secret knowledge? To my ear, this sounds a lot like what Peter Solomon's captor claims you, alone, can unlock.
Well, I can hardly believe...
What you believe is not the point. No matter what you believe, you must concede that this man might himself believe that the Masonic Pyramid is real.
The man's a lunatic. He may well believe that SBB-13 is the entrance to a giant underground pyramid that contains all the lost wisdom of the ancients. Sato stood perfectly still, her eyes seething.
The crisis I am facing tonight is not a fairy tale, Professor. It is quite real, I assure you.
A cold silence hung between them.
Ma'am,
Anderson finally said, gesturing to another secure door 10 feet away.
We're almost there, if you'd like to continue.
Sato finally broke eye contact with Langdon, motioning for Anderson to move on. They followed the security chief through the secure doorway, which deposited them in a narrow passage. Langdon looked left and then right. You've got to be kidding. He was standing in the longest hallway he had ever seen. Chapter 31. Trish Dunn felt the familiar surge of adrenaline as she exited the bright lights of the cube and moved into the raw darkness of the void. The SMSC's front gate had just called to say that Catherine's guest, Dr. Abaddon, had arrived and required an escort back to Pod 5. Trish had offered to bring him back, mostly out of curiosity. Catherine had said very little about the man who would be visiting them, and Trish was intrigued. The man was apparently someone Peter Solomon trusted deeply. The Solomons never invited anyone back to the cube. This was a first.
I hope he handles the crossing okay, Trish thought as she moved through the frigid darkness.
The last thing she needed was Catherine's VIP panicking when he realized what he had to do to get to the lab.
The first time is always the worst.
Trish's first time had been about a year ago. She had accepted Catherine's job offer, signed a non-disclosure, and then come to the SMSC with Catherine to see the lab. The two women had walked the length of the street, arriving at a metal door marked Pod 5. Even though Catherine had tried to prepare her by describing the lab's remote location, Trish was not ready for what she saw when the pod door hissed open. The void. Catherine stepped over the threshold, walked a few feet into the perfect blackness, and then motioned for Trish to follow.
Trust me, you won't get lost.
Trish pictured herself wandering in a pitch-black stadium-sized room and broke a sweat at the mere thought.
We have a guidance system to keep you on track.
Catherine pointed to the floor. Very low tech.
Trish squinted through the darkness at the rough cement floor. It took a moment to see it in the darkness, but there was a narrow carpet runner that had been laid down in a straight line. The carpet ran like a roadway, disappearing into the darkness.
"See with your feet," Catherine said, turning and walking off. "Just follow right behind me."
As Catherine disappeared into the blackness, Trish swallowed her fear and followed.
This is insane.
She had taken only a few steps down the carpet when the Pod 5 door swung shut behind her, snuffing out the last faint hint of light. Pulse racing, Trish turned all of her attention to the feeling of the carpet beneath her feet. She had ventured only a handful of steps down the soft runner when she felt the side of her right foot hit hard cement. Startled, she instinctively corrected to the left, getting both feet back on soft carpet. Catherine's voice materialized up ahead in the blackness, her words almost entirely swallowed by the lifeless acoustics of this abyss.
"The human body is amazing," she said. "If you deprive it of one sensory input, the other senses take over almost instantly. Right now, the nerves in your feet are literally tuning themselves to become more sensitive."
"Good thing," Trish thought, correcting course again. They walked in silence for what seemed entirely too long.
"How much farther?" Trish finally asked. "We're about halfway."
Catherine's voice sounded more distant now. Trish sped up, doing her best to stay composed, but the breadth of the darkness felt like it would engulf her.
"I can't see 1 millimeter in front of my face." "Catherine, how do you know when to stop walking?"
"You'll know in a moment," Catherine said.
That was a year ago. And now, tonight, Trish was once again in the void, heading in the opposite direction, out to the lobby to retrieve her boss's guest. A sudden change in carpet texture beneath her feet alerted her that she was 3 yards from the exit. The warning track, as it was called by Peter Solomon, an avid baseball fan. Trish stopped short, pulled out her key card, and groped in the darkness along the wall until she found the raised slot and inserted her card. The door hissed open. Trish squinted into the welcoming light of the SMSC hallway.
Made it.
Again. Moving through the deserted corridors, Trish found herself thinking about the bizarre redacted file they had found on a secure network.
Ancient portal? Secret location underground?
She wondered if Mark Zubianis was having any luck figuring out where the mysterious document was located. Inside the control room, Catherine stood in the soft glow of the plasma wall and gazed up at the enigmatic document they had uncovered. She had isolated her key phrases now and felt increasingly certain that the document was talking about the same far-flung legend that her brother had apparently shared with Dr. Abaddon. Secret location, underground, where the... somewhere in Washington, D.C. The coordinates uncovered an ancient portal that led... warning the pyramid holds dangerous... decipher this engraved symbol on to unveil...
I need to see the rest of the file, Catherine thought.
She stared a moment longer and then flipped the plasma wall's power switch. Catherine always turned off this energy-intensive display so as not to waste the fuel cell's liquid hydrogen reserves. She watched as her keywords slowly faded, collapsing down into a tiny white dot, which hovered in the middle of the wall and then finally twinkled out. She turned and walked back toward her office. Dr. Abaddon would be arriving momentarily, and she wanted to make him feel welcome. Chapter 32.
"Almost there,"
Anderson said, guiding Langdon and Sato down the seemingly endless corridor that ran the entire length of the Capitol's eastern foundation.
"In Lincoln's day, this passage had a dirt floor and was filled with rats."
Langdon felt grateful the floor had been tiled. He was not a big fan of rats. The group continued on, their footfalls drumming up an eerie, uneven echo in the long passageway. Doorways lined the long hallway, some closed but many ajar. Many of the rooms down on this level looked abandoned. Langdon noticed the numbers on the doors were now descending, and after a while, seemed to be running out. SB4, SB3, SB2, SB1.
They continued past an unmarked door, but Anderson stopped short when the numbers began ascending again. HB1, HB2.
Sorry, Anderson said. Missed it. I almost never come down this deep.
The group backed up a few yards to an old metal door, which Langdon now realized was located at the hallway's central point, the meridian that divided the Senate basement, SB, and the House basement, HB. As it turned out, the door was indeed marked, but its engraving was so faded, it was almost imperceptible. SBB.
Here we are, Anderson said. Keys will be arriving any moment.
Sato frowned and checked her watch. Langdon eyed the SBB marking and asked Anderson, "Why is this space associated with the Senate side, even though it's in the middle?" Anderson looked puzzled.
"What do you mean?"
"It says SBB, which begins with an S, not an H." Anderson shook his head.
"The S in SBB doesn't stand for Senate. It..."
"Chief?" a guard called out in the distance. He came jogging up the hallway toward them, holding out a key.
"Sorry, sir. It took a few minutes. We couldn't locate the main SBB key. This is a spare from an auxiliary box."
"The original is missing?"
Anderson said, sounding surprised.
"Probably lost," the guard replied, arriving out of breath. "Nobody has requested access down here for ages."
Anderson took the key.
"No secondary key for SBB-13?
"Sorry. So far we're not finding keys for any of the rooms in the SBB. McDonald's on it now."
The guard pulled out his radio and spoke into it.
"Bob, I'm with the chief. Any additional info yet on the key for SBB-13?
The guard's radio crackled, and a voice replied,
"Actually, yeah, it's strange. I'm seeing no entries since we computerized, but the hard logs indicate all the storage rooms in the SBB were cleaned out and abandoned more than 20 years ago. They're now listed as unused space."
He paused.
"All except for SBB-13.
Anderson grabbed the radio.
"This is the chief. What do you mean, all except SBB-13?
"Well, sir," the voice replied, "I've got a handwritten notation here that designates SBB-13 as private. It was a long time ago, but it's written and initialed by the architect himself."
The term architect, Langdon knew, was not a reference to the man who had designed the Capitol, but rather to the man who ran it. Similar to a building manager, the man appointed as architect of the Capitol was in charge of everything, including maintenance, restoration, security, hiring personnel, and assigning offices.
"The strange thing," the voice on the radio said, "is that the architect's notation indicates that this private space was set aside for the use of Peter Solomon."
Langdon, Sato, and Anderson all exchanged startled looks.
"I'm guessing, sir," the voice continued, "that Mr. Solomon has our primary key to the SBB, as well as any keys to SBB-13.
Langdon could not believe his ears. Peter has a private room in the basement of the Capitol? He had always known Peter Solomon had secrets, but this was surprising even to Langdon.
"Okay," Anderson said, clearly unamused. "We're hoping to get access to SBB-13 specifically, so keep looking for a secondary key."
"Will do, sir. We're also working on the digital image that you requested."
"Thank you,"
Anderson interrupted, pressing the talk button and cutting him off.
"That will be all. Send that file to Director Sato's BlackBerry as soon as you have it."
"Understood, sir."
The radio went silent. Anderson handed the radio back to the guard in front of them. The guard pulled out a photocopy of a blueprint and handed it to his chief.
"Sir, the SBB is in gray, and we've notated with an X which room is SBB-13, so it shouldn't be hard to find. The area is quite small."
Anderson thanked the guard and turned his focus to the blueprint as the young man hurried off. Langdon looked on, surprised to see the astonishing number of cubicles that made up the bizarre maze beneath the U.S. Capitol. Anderson studied the blueprint for a moment, nodded, and then stuffed it into his pocket. Turning to the door marked SBB, he raised the key, but hesitated, looking uneasy about opening it. Langdon felt similar misgivings. He had no idea what was behind this door, but he was quite certain that whatever Solomon had hidden down here, he wanted to keep private. Very private. Sato cleared her throat, and Anderson got the message. The chief took a deep breath inserted the key, and tried to turn it. The key didn't move. For a split second, Langdon felt hopeful the key was wrong. On the second try, though, the lock turned, and Anderson heaved the door open. As the heavy door creaked outward, damp air rushed out into the corridor. Langdon peered into the darkness, but could see nothing at all.
"Professor?"
Anderson said, glancing back at Langdon as he groped blindly for a light switch.
"To answer your question, the S in SBB doesn't stand for Senate. It stands for sub."
"Sub?" Langdon asked, puzzled. Anderson nodded and flicked the switch just inside the door. A single bulb illuminated an alarmingly steep staircase, descending into inky blackness.
"SBB is the Capitol's sub-basement."
Chapter 33 Systems Security Specialist Mark Zubianis was sinking deeper into his futon and scowling at the information on his laptop screen. What the hell kind of address is this? His best hacking tools were entirely ineffective at breaking into the document or at unmasking Trish's mysterious IP address. 10 minutes had passed, and Zubianis's program was still pounding away in vain at the network firewalls. They showed little hope of penetration. No wonder they're overpaying me. He was about to retool and try a different approach when his phone rang. "Trish, for Christ's sake, I said I'd call you." He muted the football game and answered, "Yeah? Is this Mark Zubianis?" a man asked. "At 357 Kingston Drive in Washington?" Zubianis could hear other muffled conversations in the background. "A telemarketer during the playoffs? Are they insane?" "Let me guess, I won a week in Anguilla?" "No," the voice replied, with no trace of humor. "This is system security for the Central Intelligence Agency. We would like to know why you are attempting to hack one of our classified databases." Three stories above the Capitol Building's sub-basement, in the wide open spaces of the visitor center, security guard Nunez locked the main entry doors as he did every night at this time. As he headed back across the expansive marble floors, he thought of the man in the army surplus jacket with the tattoos. "I let him in." Nunez wondered if he would have a job tomorrow. As he headed toward the escalator, a sudden pounding on the outside doors caused him to turn. He squinted back toward the main entrance and saw an elderly African-American man outside, rapping on the glass with his open palm and motioning to be let in. Nunez shook his head and pointed to his watch. The man pounded again and stepped into the light. He was immaculately dressed in a blue suit and had close-cropped graying hair. Nunez's pulse quickened. Holy shit. Even at a distance, Nunez now recognized who this man was. He hurried back to the entrance and unlocked the door. "I'm sorry, sir. Please, please come in." Warren Bellamy, architect of the Capitol, stepped across the threshold and thanked Nunez with a polite nod. Bellamy was lithe and slender, with an erect posture and piercing gaze that exuded the confidence of a man in full control of his surroundings. For the last 25 years, Bellamy had served as the supervisor of the U.S. Capitol. "May I help you, sir?" Nunez asked.
"Thank you. Yes."
Bellamy enunciated his words with crisp precision. As a Northeastern Ivy League graduate, his diction was so exacting, he sounded almost British.
"I've just learned that you had an incident here this evening."
He looked deeply concerned.
"Yes, sir. It was..." "Where's Chief Anderson?"
"Downstairs with Director Sato from the CIA's Office of Security." Bellamy's eyes widened with concern.
"The CIA is here?"
"Yes, sir. Director Sato arrived almost immediately after the incident."
"Why?"
Bellamy demanded. Nunez shrugged, as if I was going to ask. Bellamy strode directly toward the escalators.
"Where are they?"
"They just went to the lower levels." Nunez hastened after him. Bellamy glanced back with a look of concern.
"Downstairs? Why?"
"I don't really know. I just heard it on my radio." Bellamy was moving faster now.
"Take me to them right away."
"Yes, sir." As the two men hurried across the open expanse, Nunez caught a glimpse of a large golden ring on Bellamy's finger. Nunez pulled out his radio.
I'll alert the chief that you're coming down.
No.
Bellamy's eyes flashed dangerously.
I'd prefer to be unannounced.
Nunez had made some big mistakes tonight, but failing to alert Chief Anderson that the architect was now in the building would be his last.
Sir? He said, uneasy.
I think Chief Anderson would prefer... You are aware that I employ Mr. Anderson?
Bellamy said. Nunez nodded.
Then I think he would prefer you obey my wishes.
Chapter 34 Trish Dunn entered the SMSC lobby and looked up with surprise. The guest waiting here looked nothing like the usual bookish flannel-clad doctors who entered this building, those of anthropology, oceanography, geology, and other scientific fields. Quite to the contrary, Dr. Abaddon looked almost aristocratic in his impeccably tailored suit. He was tall, with a broad torso, well-tanned face, and perfectly combed blonde hair that gave Trish the impression he was more accustomed to luxuries than to laboratories.
Dr. Abaddon, I presume?
Trish said, extending her hand. The man looked uncertain, but he took Trish's plump hand in his broad palm.
I'm sorry. And you are?
Trish Dunn, she replied. I'm Catherine's assistant. She asked me to escort you back to her lab.
Oh, I see.
The man smiled now.
Very nice to meet you, Trish. My apologies if I seemed confused. I was under the impression Catherine was here alone this evening.
He motioned down the hall.
But I'm all yours. Lead the way.
Despite the man's quick recovery, Trish had seen the flash of disappointment in his eyes. She now suspected the motive for Catherine's secrecy earlier about Dr. Abaddon. A budding romance, maybe? Catherine never discussed her social life, but her visitor was attractive and well-groomed, and although younger than Catherine, he clearly came from her world of wealth and privilege. Nonetheless, whatever Dr. Abaddon had imagined tonight's visit might entail, Trish's presence did not seem to be part of his plan. At the lobby's security checkpoint, a lone guard quickly pulled off his headphones, and Trish could hear the Redskins game blaring. The guard put Dr. Abaddon through the usual visitor routine of metal detectors and temporary security badges.
"Who's winning?"
Dr. Abaddon said affably as he emptied his pockets of a cell phone, some keys, and a cigarette lighter. "Skins by three," the guard said, sounding eager to get back. "Hell of a game."
"Mr. Solomon will be arriving shortly," Trish told the guard. "Would you please send him back to the lab once he arrives?"
"Will do." The guard gave an appreciative wink as they passed through.
"Thanks for the heads up. I'll look busy."
Trish's comment had been not only for the benefit of the guard, but also to remind Dr. Abaddon that Trish was not the only one intruding on his private evening here with Catherine.
"So, how do you know Catherine?"
Trish asked, glancing up at the mysterious guest. Dr. Abaddon chuckled.
"Oh, it's a long story. We've been working on something together."
"Understood," Trish thought. "None of my business."
"This is an amazing facility,"
Abaddon said, glancing around as they moved down the massive corridor.
"I've never actually been here."
His airy tone was becoming more genial with every step, and Trish noticed he was actively taking it all in. In the bright lights of the hallway, she also noticed that his face looked like he had a fake tan.
Odd.
Nonetheless, as they navigated the deserted corridors, Trish gave him a general synopsis of the SMSC's purpose and function, including the various pods and their contents. The visitor looked impressed.
"Sounds like this place has a treasure trove of priceless artifacts. I would have expected guards posted everywhere."
"No need," Trish said, motioning to the row of fisheye lenses lining the ceiling high above.
"Security here is automated. Every inch of this corridor is recorded 24/7, and this corridor is the spine of the facility. It's impossible to access any of the rooms off this corridor without a key card and PIN number."
"Efficient use of cameras."
"Knock on wood, we've never had a theft. Then again, this is not the kind of museum anyone would rob. There's not much call on the black market for extinct flowers, Inuit kayaks, or giant squid carcasses."
Dr. Abaddon chuckled.
"I suppose you're right.
Our biggest security threat is rodents and insects."
Trish explained how the building prevented insect infestations by freezing all SMSC refuse, and also by an architectural feature called a dead zone, an inhospitable compartment between double walls, which surrounded the entire building like a sheath.
Incredible,
Abaddon said.
So where is Catherine and Peter's lab?
Pod 5, Trish said. It's all the way at the end of this hallway. Abaddon halted suddenly, spinning to his right toward a small window.
My word. Will you look at that?
Trish laughed. Yeah, that's Pod 3. They call it Wet Pod.
Wet?
Abaddon said, face pressed to the glass. There are over 3,000 gallons of liquid ethanol in there. Remember the giant squid carcass I mentioned earlier?
That's the squid.
Dr. Abaddon turned from the window momentarily, his eyes wide.
It's huge.
A female Archituthis, Trish said. She's over 40 feet. Dr. Abaddon, apparently enraptured by the sight of the squid, seemed unable to pull his eyes away from the glass. For a moment, the grown man reminded Trish of a little boy at a pet store window, wishing he could go in and see a puppy. 5 seconds later, he was still staring longingly through the window. Okay, okay, Trish finally said, laughing as she inserted her keycard and typed her PIN number. Come on, I'll show you the squid. As Malak stepped into the dimly lit world of Pod 3, he scanned the walls for security cameras. Catherine's pudgy little assistant began rattling on about the specimens in this room. Malak tuned her out. He had no interest whatsoever in giant squids. His only interest was in using this dark, private space to solve an unexpected problem. Chapter 35. The wooden stairs descending to the Capitol's sub-basement were as steep and shallow as any stairs Langdon had ever traversed. His breathing was faster now, and his lungs felt tight. The air down here was cold and damp, and Langdon couldn't help but flash on a similar set of stairs he had taken a few years back into the Vatican's necropolis, the city of the dead. Ahead of him, Anderson led the way with his flashlight. Behind Langdon, Sato followed closely, her tiny hands occasionally pressing into Langdon's back. I'm going as fast as I can. Langdon inhaled deeply, trying to ignore the cramped walls on either side of him. There was barely room for his shoulders on this staircase, and his day bag now scraped down the sidewall.
Maybe you should leave your bag above,
Sato offered behind him. I'm fine, Langdon replied, having no intention of letting it out of his sight. He pictured Peter's little package, and could not begin to imagine how it might relate to anything in the sub-basement of the U.S. Capitol.
Just a few more steps, Anderson said. Almost there.
The group had descended into darkness, moving beyond the reach of the staircase's lone light bulb. When Langdon stepped off the final wooden tread, he could feel that the floor beneath his feet was dirt. Journey to the center of the earth. Sato stepped down behind him. Anderson now raised his beam, examining their surroundings. The sub-basement was less of a basement than it was an ultra-narrow corridor that ran perpendicular to the stairs. Anderson shone his light left, and then right, and Langdon could see the passage was only about 50 feet long and lined on both sides with small wooden doors. The doors abutted one another so closely that the rooms behind them could not have been more than 10 feet wide. Acme's storage meets the catacombs of Domitila, Langdon thought as Anderson consulted the blueprint. The tiny section depicting the sub-basement was marked with an X to show the location of SBB-13. Langdon couldn't help but notice that the layout was identical to a 14-tomb mausoleum, 7 vaults facing 7 vaults, with one removed to accommodate the stairs they had just descended. 13 in all. He suspected America's 13 conspiracy theorists would have a field day if they knew there were exactly 13 storage rooms buried beneath the U.S. Capitol. Some found it suspicious that the Great Seal of the United States had 13 stars, 13 arrows, 13 pyramid steps, 13 shield stripes, 13 olive leaves, 13 olives, 13 letters in Anuit Coptis, 13 letters in E Pluribus Unum, and on and on.
It does look abandoned,
Anderson said, shining the beam into the chamber directly in front of them. The heavy wooden door was wide open. The shaft of light illuminated a narrow stone chamber, about 10 feet wide by some 30 feet deep, like a dead-end hallway to nowhere. The chamber contained nothing more than a couple of old collapsed wooden boxes and some crumpled packing paper.